Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for December 5, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got an all Middle Eastern-themed show tonight. Almost two-thirds of the program, we'll speak with Jonathan Nitzan, who is the co-author of a book called The Global Political Economy of Israel, recently published by Pluto, ambitious attempt to theorize political economy, but also to apply it to Israel as a model over the years. And then about 40 minutes after the hour or so, we'll listen to an interview I recorded last week with Gada Karmi. I think I'm abusing the Arabic name. Apologies for you Arabic speakers out there. Who is the author of a new memoir recently published by Verso called In Search of Fatima, a Palestinian story, a memoir of her early years in Palestine and her exile into London and her revisiting her old homeland recently. Also, next week, we should be joined by Sarah Roy, who is a Harvard-based economist who specializes in the Palestinian economy. She has just been visiting the Palestinian region and will report back to us on what is happening to the economy and the people of Palestine. And a couple of things before we get to Jonathan Nitzan, kind of facts from my friends at the Partisan Defense Committee, which is a front organization for the Spartacist League, the inveterate class warriors of the Fourth International, who publish certainly the finest sectarian newspaper around, Workers' Vanguard, which is actually, despite its occasional boilerplate and dead sloganeering, actually quite an interesting publication at times, and certainly worth the $3 or $4 it costs to subscribe to it. But they're having a holiday party, which could be kind of interesting, tomorrow evening. They asked me to announce this. Join the Partisan Defense Committee at its 17th annual holiday appeal to send monthly stipends and holiday gifts for class war prisoners and their families. Join us in the fight to free Mumia Abu Jamal and all class war prisoners. And that is tomorrow night from 6 to 10 p.m. at 6 Harrison Street. For more information, call 212-406-4252. I won't be there, but if you stop by, be sure to pick up a copy of Workers' Vanguard, a very lively newspaper, which perpetrated one of the great headlines of all time about a little over 20 years ago when they said, "Hail the Red Army in Afghanistan." That is that would outrage many, many people, but that's one of the things that makes Workers' Vanguard such a lively read. And I should say a word or two about the U.S. economy, which just continues to stumble along. There are some economic releases, statistics that look good, some that look bad, but they basically all average out to zero, and there just doesn't seem to be any kind of vigorous recovery occurring. Actually, I think we'll bring that up with Jonathan Nitzan a little later, because he has an interesting theory of economic performance and the lust towards war, and actually make some sense. Tomorrow morning we'll get the employment report, the monthly take on employment and unemployment in the United States. I don't expect anything very dramatic. I expect more flatness, perhaps a mild upward drift in unemployment. But the U.S. economy fails to recover, and yet it fails to become a political issue because we're too busy beating the drums of war. And now we're joined on the line by Jonathan Nitzan, who is the co-author, along with Shimshon Bichler, I hope I'm not abusing his name as well, of The Global Political Economy of Israel, a book just published by Pluto Press. Jonathan Nitzan teaches in the politics department at York University in Toronto. Welcome to WBAI, Jonathan Nitzan.
Hi, Doug.
Thanks for joining us. This is a fairly ambitious book. You're trying at once to offer a theory of politics and economics as well as a case study of Israel. So why don't you just start by laying out exactly what you're trying to do in the book?
In a way, this is a reflection of some 20 years of work. And when we started working on this book around the early 1980s, we really wanted to understand the society that we lived in. But quickly we realized that we needed a new political economy. We needed a political economy of capital accumulation. We needed the political economy of ruling class formation, and we needed the political economy of globalization. And our feeling that developed over the years was that the existing theories of political economy were really inadequate, in our opinion. So we ended up with, as you say, a pretty ambitious attempt to develop a new political economy of capital accumulation, with Israel and the region of the Middle East being a way of really historicizing this theory. So this is basically, I think, a good preamble to what we're trying to do in the book, which is, as you say, it tries to cover quite a lot of ground from many different directions.
And I must tell the listeners that despite the ambition and the complexity, it's actually quite clearly written and wouldn't be much of a challenge to any to a non-specialist reader. You don't have to have a PhD in economics to understand this. I don't think there's actually any complicated regression equations in it or anything like that.
Yeah, we've tried to really write in order to explicate rather than to impress the reader, and that's really a curse that plagues quite a lot of the economics and politics literature that has become so academic that is practically indecipherable for ordinary people. So we try to really explain what we're doing and clarify to ourselves as well as to the reader.
Now, one of the points that you focus on is what accumulation is all about. I mean, we're used to calling this system capitalism.
Right.
A lot of people who've studied it, especially from the left, have emphasized that it's a system that is driven by the accumulation of capital.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you pin people down, they have a kind of a hard time defining exactly what they mean by capital. What do you mean by it?
Yeah, well, I'll try to give some background, so what I say perhaps will make more sense. I think that it's probably useful to begin from a distinction between politics and economics in order to understand our theorization of what capital is. I think that the distinction pretty much runs back to Adam Smith, who runs a project that tried to depoliticize the accumulation of capital in order to provide a space for the rising bourgeoisie against the ancient regime. And this project of depoliticizing accumulation has been very successful, I think. If you look at academia these days, it's very fragmented. We have departments for political science, and we have departments for economics. And we have many other disciplines, such as anthropology, philosophy, sociology, and so on and so forth. I think the consequence of this fragmentation is to really lose sight of the big picture that we call capitalism. Now, if you take a postmodern approach, which suggests that there might actually be no big picture to begin with, then probably we might end up the discussion right now. But if you believe that our world is increasingly capitalist, in other words, that capitalism becomes more and more of a universal set of institutions that dominates the world, and this fragmentation becomes a coherent analysis of this system impossible. I think that the Marxists correctly don't accept this fragmentation in principle, and Marx very much tried to actually provide a very coherent picture of capitalism as a power system. But unfortunately, I think the analysis of Marx remained anchored in a fundamental distinction which he made between the so-called base of forces of production, this is the productive aspect of capitalism, and the so-called superstructure, or between economics and politics. And although Marx, in many places in his writings, actually shows that the two are not clearly distinguished, in his theorizing, they are, and there is a real problem as a consequence of that. Now, our own view of profit and accumulation is that they cannot be depoliticized, neither in the sort of neoclassical or standard mainstream approach that politics and economics are separate. They can also not be made distinct, as radical political economists argue. So you have a system of accumulation which is anchored in production and is supported by a superstructure. We feel that accumulation is a process of commodifying power in society. So all forms of power, once they are commodified, they become capital. And I must emphasize for readers who might not be familiar with the literature, one of the main arguments of Marx is that capitalism is a form of commodification, but the one thing that doesn't appear in Marx in any explicit way is the understanding of commodification of power. Now, I think that maybe I should use a few illustrations, with your permission, to just put this thing in context. If you take a company like Microsoft, Microsoft basically pockets roughly 70% of the global profits in software. If for some reason there is, from today till tomorrow, a complete elimination of intellectual property rights. In other words, anybody can essentially copy a Microsoft product at no cost. The value and the profit of Microsoft will collapse immediately to zero. In other words, quite irrespective of the cost of production of the products of Microsoft, the accumulation process is entirely political, and it depends entirely on intellectual property rights. And I don't think that Microsoft is in any way unique in that sense. If you take, for example, banks. Banks make a profit from the interest rate differential between lending and borrowing, and interest rate differential is affected by interest rates. And interest rates is a phenomenon that is determined to a large extent by monetary policy. So if I'm buying the stocks of, say, Citicorp, I'm buying, in a way, a share in monetary policy. I'm buying a stake in the political process that sets monetary policy. Finally, an example that we will return to, hopefully, as the program continues, the oil companies. The profits of the oil companies are dependent entirely on the price of oil, and as we know, this is related to the international political economy of the Middle East. So in almost every example that you can think of, profit, and therefore the accumulation of profit in the form of capital values, as recorded in the stock market, are entirely a political process. Now, I think that radical economists or political economists wouldn't disagree with that. They would say simply that profits are created in the productive sector, and all of these power arrangements mainly reshuffle, distribute profits between the different actors. And we disagree with that fundamentally. We believe that production is a qualitative process, and that qualitative process cannot create any meaningful understanding of the so-called quantitative process that we call accumulation. Accumulation is certainly a quantitative process in the mind of capitalists, and if you look at what happened in East Asia of the accumulation crisis of 97, it's driven by numbers. And these numbers, we argue, are determined not in the so-called production process, but they are determined by the politics of production. So we have a more encompassing, I think, view of accumulation that is not entirely foreign to Marx, but it, in a way, liberates Marx from the factory and makes accumulation a process that is political in the widest possible sense. Now, I can go on, but I think that at this point, maybe I'll let you ask another question.
Yeah, I think we should turn to Israel, but I think just to putting it in a soundbite form, some of what you just said, it's wrong to talk about the links between politics and economics because they're inseparable from the first.
Yes, we feel that this separation into two spheres is just an erroneous separation to begin with. It's a fragmentation that belongs to the world of images, maybe of the 18th century of Newtonian physics. I don't think that they are appropriate for the highly politicized a form of accumulation of the 20th and the 21st century. So we don't, or we try to not talk at all about politics and economics as two different concepts or two different spheres.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Knitson, who is the co-author, along with Shimshon Bishler, of The Global Political Economy of Israel, a book just published by Pluto Press. And let's talk a little bit about the history of the Israel. I think in the popular mind, Israel was, to many people, a socialist dream, although one based on nationalism and ethnicity, but a socialist dream that somehow went awry. And what's your response to that kind of standard history?
I think that it's what you're saying is true about the conventional wisdom, and it's a conventional wisdom that may apply to perhaps some other countries. The original colonization of Israel, of course, was not marked by business enterprise. It's different than what happened in the United States. But it was certainly a power process. And the power process was initially dominated by quasi-state institutions, primarily political parties, in the 1920s and 1930s. But from the beginning, the political process and the institutions of the state created, in a way, a cocoon for the beginning of the commodification of power. In other words, it gave birth to business enterprises that started commodifying themselves and gradually have taken the lead and eventually have taken over many of the aspects of the state in Israel. If you fast forward into the end of the 20th century, Israel is one of the most capitalized societies in the world. So our take on it is that if you are to understand the history of Israel, it's a history of capitalization rather than a frustrating, disappointing, a dream going sour of socialism. If you would look, in fact, on the ideology of the many people considered the founding fathers of Israel, people like Berl Katzenelson, Al-Ozarov, Ben-Gurion, they have used socialist ideology as a mechanism for colonization, as a mechanism for power. But they, from the very beginning, and certainly from the 1930s, have accommodated business interests and cooperated with business interests and gradually have, over the years, allow the commodification and increasing concentration of these business interests. And if you look at the history of the ruling class in Israel, which has never been told in any serious way, I think that in many ways this book is the first book to actually try to tell the story of the ruling class. There was, by the way, an earlier book published by Shimshon Bichlil and Shlomo Frenkel in Israel, in 1984, that was called Israel's Aristocracy of Finance, and it was a book that actually detailed the story of the Israeli ruling class, but it did it only from the personal and societal perspective, and it wasn't really trying to anchor that in the processes of accumulation. So the history of Israel from the beginning is a history from a personal perspective of very much an increasingly intertwined set of elites whose different trunks are becoming increasingly difficult to disentangle. If you read into the real histories of the real families and the real ideologies, you see a society whose ruling class is not much different than the ruling classes of many paternalistic societies in Latin America or in other Middle Eastern countries.
Yeah, I mean, the pages where you're telling the story, it almost reads like a novel. All these people knew each other, married each other. It was really, if you got them all into a small hotel ballroom, you had pretty much the entire ruling class of Israel. It's a small country, but it still is a strikingly small elite.
It is a small elite, but I think that if you were to look at other societies, and if you look and particularly search for these links, you might actually find them, because nothing of what we tell is secret in any way, and just nobody has bothered to study this history and this structure. And in fact, we have tried to study that, and we were encountering enormous opposition within Israel to any attempt to publish any of this stuff. So there's a political dimension.
And correspondingly, there's also a tremendous concentration on the of the industrial groups and financial groups that own and run Israel. Could you talk a bit about who those entities are?
Yes. Originally, right now, we are in a situation, we argue in the book, that it's very hard to talk even about an Israeli capitalist class, because in many ways it is part of a transnational class. So you have many foreign investors owning assets in Israel, and many of the Israeli bourgeoisie have diversified quite extensively outside of the country, not so much in the region, but in North America, in Europe, Latin America, Asia, etc. Now, up until the early 1990s, Israel was dominated by about five huge conglomerates, not very different from the Keiretsu in Japan or the Chaebol in South Korea or the South African large mining groups. And the origin of these groups date back to the beginning of colonization, more or less in the 1920s. So many of these, or some of these groups, were founded as quasi-state institutions for colonization of the region. Some of them were owned by the, actually by the labor union, by the Histadrut, and one or two of them were privately owned from the beginning. But as I said, over time, all of these institutions, all of these large conglomerates have become increasingly commodified. Even before they were entirely privatized, they acted as capitalist enterprise. In other words, they tried to basically outperform, beat the average, accumulate faster than others. And eventually, from the 1970s up until the 1990s, all of them have become private for all intents and purposes. Right now, Israel is probably one of the more concentrated, centralized political economies in the world from the perspective of its ownership structure.
And also has a very unequal distribution of income.
Yes, this is another interesting development. In the 1940s, the top 20% of the population earned roughly three or slightly more than three times the bottom 20% of the population. The United States at the time had a comparable income distribution with a ratio of about, I think, 10 or 11 to 1. And if you fast forward after 60 years of Americanization, the United States, the ratio is about, I think, 13 or 14 now, and in Israel it's roughly 25. And 25 ratio of the top to bottom 20% is Latin American standard. So by, in comparison to industrialized countries, Israel is by far the most unequally distributed. It has one of the most, or the most, unequal distribution of income in the industrial world.
And do those figures include the occupied territories?
No. These figures are only for Israel without the occupied territories. If you were to include the Palestinian population, the figures are going to be much more skewed, of course.
Yeah, it would make Brazil look like Sweden almost.
Probably. Israel, if you walk the streets of Israel in the last 5 years, you see a lot of hungry people. You see a lot of homeless people. This was unheard of 10 years ago, even 10 years ago.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Nitzan, who is the co-author of a book called The Global Political Economy of Israel, just published by Pluto Press. And we've got a bit more territory to cover in only about 10 more minutes, so let's turn to the present. I mean, the Israeli economy is not doing very well, at least by conventional measures, but all I can talk about is war. Now, my friend Joel Shalit, who is the author, among other things, of a book called Jerusalem Calling, argues that Israeli society needs war so it can avoid facing its own internal schisms. What do you make of that argument?
I would first argue that I'm not sure what Israeli society needs, because I'm not sure what is meant by Israeli society. There are, as you say, conflicts within Israel. I think that an adequate way to approach that is to think of Israeli accumulation and in relation to war within a much broader picture. Because Israeli accumulation has never been, and certainly not now, some sort of an independent process. It's a process that is very much linked to the global political economy, and it's certainly very much linked to American interests in particular. In the book, we develop what we believe to be a novel theory, trying to periodize the processes of accumulation in the 20th century. And we argue that capitalism is increasingly oscillating between two regimes. One regime that is based on expansion, economic expansion, and mostly on mergers and acquisitions. In other words, growth of profitability and corporate size by companies buying each other. And another mechanism is a mechanism of stagflation. In other words, a mechanism in which profitability is increased, especially by large firms, through a redistribution via inflation, and inflation being accompanied by a crisis. And this, I think, is pretty important to understand what is happening now in the region and in Israel, because our argument is that the 1980s and the 1990s were a period of expansion through mergers and acquisition, and primarily global mergers and acquisition. And that period has ended more or less with the end of the Clinton administration. And we're moving again towards a period in which capital finds it difficult to expand through mergers and acquisition, and therefore resorts more and more to redistribution through price changes. Now, historically, in the 20th century, periods of inflation were associated, certainly since the 1970s, were associated with conflict in the Middle East, because conflict in the Middle East is a mechanism of generating high prices of oil and therefore pushing the entire structure of industrial and non-industrial prices. And I think that one way of understanding the so-called new imperialism that is happening in the Middle East, and of which Israel is part, is an attempt to move in that direction. And that's kind of an ironic twist, I think, because many people on the left argue that every time the U.S. is involved directly or indirectly in a war in the Middle East, it's chasing oil reserves. It wants to make oil cheap for the American economy. And I think that there is certainly an attempt to control oil, but it is more complex than that. And if you were to examine the history of oil prices since the 1970s, it was the main determinant of profits of the oil companies. In other words, the oil companies profited not from controlling oil directly, but from manipulating the price of oil. Whether they manipulated the price of oil or OPEC is another question, but they have a clear interest in rising price of oil. So there's a conflict, I think, in the U.S. ruling class between different groups, and right now the oil companies certainly ride pretty high in the U.S. administration, and their interest is not in access to oil so much as in a high price of oil, which seems to me pretty consistent with the U.S. insistence on going towards war. It will also solve, I think, if you can call this a solution, enormous fears that have been built over the past 2 years, not only among oil companies, but among all big companies, of deflationary crisis. There's a real fear that the world is moving towards deflation, and a trigger of a crisis in the Middle East can resolve that problem. So you have a set of interests, kind of a staggered interest led by oil companies and by big corporations in general, that increasingly see this conflict as not necessarily such a bad thing, particularly if it raises the price of oil.
Yeah, I should say the show's Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And I'm speaking with Jonathan Knitson, who is the co-author of The Global Political Economy of Israel, just published by Pluto Press. And one of the many virtues of your book is that you resist looking at political economies in aggregate terms, and you're always like focusing on sectors, sectoral interests, individual capital's interests, big versus little, one industry versus another industry. One of the themes in the book is this what you call the weapon dollar petrodollar axis. Now, historically, in the United States, that weapon dollar, the arms contractors and such, and oil companies have leaned towards the Republican Party, and they've got their man is in the White House right now, and at the same coincidentally, we're seeing this great rush towards war, and this coalition has a material passion for instability, not stability. Could you talk about how this feeds into the current crisis around Iraq?
Yeah, this has been a kind of an ongoing theme in the literature on the realist literature or the international relations literature about U.S. material interests in the region. And many have written on the interest that the United States had to have, as I said, access to oil reserves. And if you look at the history of U.S. control over oil in the 20th century, it has changed quite dramatically during the 1970s. During the 1970s, many of the oil, all of the oil companies in the region had to basically give up their concessions because all of the oil was nationalized by OPEC. The oil industry initially objected to this challenge to its private authority, if you like, in the world because it dominated world oil until that period. But gradually it accepted the mechanism, a more sophisticated political mechanism, in which oil is formally, officially controlled by OPEC, and the oil companies are sort of playing a secondary role. But that secondary role was only at the formal level. If you look at the profits of the oil companies and contrast them with the revenues of OPEC, they're essentially moving together almost entirely. So the interest of OPEC and the interest of the oil companies are almost the same. Now, it makes you ask a question: if the United States government is in some way influenced by oil, what is the interest of oil? What is the interest, of U.S. policy? Now, if you bring into this picture also the interest of the armament companies who have relied increasingly on the commercialization of arms exports, so whereas oil has become increasingly politicized, having OPEC essentially act as the front window, the armament interests have become increasingly commercialized because domestic demand tends to fluctuate with the risk of war, and when the risk of external war is limited, you need to actually export a lot of weapons in order to remain viable. So the armament industry has become dependent on export sales, and guess what? Much of those export sales went to the Middle East and were financed by the different oil crises. So you started to have a process which we call energy conflicts, a process of energy conflicts in which every energy conflict create an increase in oil revenues for the OPEC countries, particularly in the Middle East. It increases the profits of the oil companies. At the same time, it provides enormous demand for armaments that are exported to the Middle East. So in a way, there was formed in the 1970s a coalition, an implicit coalition, between the armament companies and the oil companies whose interests are in conflict in the Middle East, sometimes even in war in the Middle East. These are the material interests or the profit interests or the accumulation interests of that coalition. Now, obviously, that coalition does not always have its way. During the 1990s, the world was driven, as I said, by a regime of expansion through mergers and acquisitions, in which the petroleum and armament coalition was relatively weak. Nowadays, I think, as the world moves towards an inflationary mode of accumulation, the interest of the weapon dollar, petrodollar coalition are again likely to ride pretty high, and I think they do ride pretty high if you examine the composition of the Bush administration.
All right, I'm afraid we have to end it there. And thank you very much for joining us, Jonathan Knitson, who is the co-author of the book The Global Political Economy of Israel, just published by Pluto Press, and there's certainly a lot there. I recommend it. Everyone run out and get a copy. And we'll be back in just a moment after this word from Dmitry Shostakovich. And that was the first movement of Dmitri Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 11, played by the Sorel Quartet, and a little relief from the usual diet of techno and punk this week. And now, an interview I recorded last week with Gada Harmi. I think it's Harmi, but my Arabic is not very good. K-A-R-M-I is how you spell her last name. And she's the author of In Search of Fatima, a Palestinian memoir. It is a memoir of her childhood in Palestine and her exile in London and then her return to Palestine a few years ago. It's just published by Verso, and here is Gada Harmi. Welcome to WBAI, Gada Harmi. You come from a part of the world in which some Zionists say people didn't live. It was an empty piece of land for people without a land. Tell me a little bit about the society you were born into and when.
Well, of course, it's a total nonsense that this land was empty. It was certainly very full and had been full for thousands of years with its own inhabitants called Palestinians. The society I was born into at the time, right at the beginning of my early childhood, largely unaware of the threat and the danger that would be coming from Jewish groups who lived, of course, outside the area, lived in Europe, and had made a decision to come to Palestine and establish a Jewish state. But as a young child, of course, neither I nor my parents were particularly aware of any of this. We were just quite ordinary people. We were an ordinary family living an ordinary life, I would say.
And how was this ordinariness then disrupted? What were the signs that trouble was coming?
Well, I suppose we personally, our own family, didn't feel anything till probably about 1946. It's an odd thing to say this, you know, because the entry of European Jews began in the early 1920s, and more of them started to pour in during the 1930s because of Nazism. There was a group of Palestinians, of very politicized Palestinians, who were well aware of the danger. They could see that the British authorities who ruled Palestine at the time had allowed these Jews to come in and were encouraging them, in fact, in this enterprise called Zionism, which would end up in establishing the State of Israel.
What was the British interest in encouraging this?
Well, it's a very good question. Many, many historians have speculated as to why the British played this perfidious role, really, in Palestine. They lied to the Arabs, telling them that they were going to attain independence. We thought we were going to attain independence from Britain, but all the time they were aiding the Zionist project and letting Jews into the country. The received wisdom is that Britain, being a colonialist power, of course, at the time, was interested in having a friendly state in the Arab region in the shape of a grateful Jewish state, grateful to the British for having helped the Jewish state to be established, and therefore British interests would continue to be furthered in a very important strategic region. That's the usual reading of what happened. But of course, my book deals with the human side of all of that. I mean, what did that mean to us as a family?
Right, so what did it mean? I mean, you describe friendships between your family and some of your Jewish neighbors. It was not initially a hostile relation.
No, not at all. Actually, there were Jews living in our street. We had quite a lot of German Jewish doctors, and they were highly respected because they were supposed to be very good. And my brother, who had childhood eczema, was treated by German Jewish doctors. There was really very little hostility, so long as we saw these people as immigrants, you see. It was not strange for us. We didn't think there was anything wrong. The problem began when when the gloves came off, when it became clear that these weren't ordinary immigrants. These were people intent on taking over our country.
And how did you first start noticing this? What were the signs in your daily life?
Well, if I look back on myself as a child and my immediate family, I think probably the first time that the drama entered our lives was when the Jewish terrorists, and they were called terrorists by the British at the time. That was how the term was first used, by the way. It was applied to Jews. Now, these Jewish terrorists blew up the King David Hotel. The King David Hotel was the headquarters of the British Mandate government. And, of course, what the Jewish groups wanted was to attack the British to get them to leave the country so that they could take it over. They no longer wanted the British authorities to be in there. So they had a war against the British initially, not so much against us Arabs. But, you see, there were many people in the King David Hotel. About 90 people were killed that day, many of them Arabs. Quite a few of them neighbors who lived in our street.
And a future prime minister of Israel was involved in that, right? Menachem Begin?
Indeed. I mean, the whole event was headed up and organized by people who would later become Israeli prime ministers. Not only was Begin one of them, but there was Shamir, was the head of another group, a terrorist gang, who were responsible for several massacres and attacks on civilians in Palestine.
So that was that. What year was that?
That was that day. The King David Hotel blowing up was 1946.
And so that was a sign that things were getting pretty tense.
Yes. I think from then on, we realized life was not normal. Now, of course, we believed, hoped and believed that it wouldn't come to anything too bad for us. I mean, you have to imagine that this was our country. We lived in it as, say, what can I say, an American who lives in New York. He doesn't think just because there are problems or bombings or something like this, if you like, the attack on the Trade Center, doesn't mean he's going to lose New York. It means these are attacks. And that's what we thought. There was never any thought in our mind that we would actually lose our country.
But over the next couple of years, I guess, things got much more disturbing, and at some point your family decided it was time to leave.
That's right. Things became a crescendo, and this whole bit is described in the first part of my book, that events assumed a momentum of their own, things got worse and worse, more and more dangerous, and eventually we, as a family in our street, could no longer go to school, we couldn't go out to shop. It was terrifying. So my parents decided in April 1948, note 1 month before the State of Israel was declared. So we did not leave under the, you know, during the Arab-Israeli War. That is another myth, I'm afraid. Many Palestinians were either evicted or fled in fear before May 1948. Now, our family left in the belief that, of course, my parents couldn't subject young children to this kind of danger. So they thought, well, we will evacuate as you do in times of war. We will go somewhere else, we will stay there for a short while, it will settle down, we'll all go home again. That's what they thought. And so in April 1948, we left. And this moment for me, I was a child, but it's so painful when I remember saying goodbye to my dog. I loved my dog, I loved my home. I mean, after all, that's what made up my life. And I was saying goodbye to it. I had no way of knowing that we would or wouldn't come back. For me, it was a really traumatic, shattering experience.
I'm speaking with Gada Carmi, who is the author of In Search of Fatima, a memoir just published by Versa. So after some detours, you ended up in London.
Yes, now that's a strange part of the story. Most Palestinians at the time when this tragedy happened, when they had to leave Palestine, ended up near the borders of the newly established state. I mean, they were in Jordan or Egypt or Syria or Lebanon, I mean, around. A very small number of whom we were part went further afield. And the reason for that was very simple. Palestinians, having been forced to leave their homes, had no jobs to go to and no money, and we'd run out of money. We stayed with my grandparents, but they didn't have much money, and so my father was offered a job in the BBC in London, which at that time was developing its Arabic service, so they wanted native Arabic speakers. And so my father was invited to go, and he thought, we'll go for a short while, at least he's got a job, he's got a bit of money then, and then he can get us started into school, and then of course, because that was the belief all the time, everything would settle down and we'd all go back to Jerusalem. So we left Damascus, where we were after having left Jerusalem, and ended up in London.
And what was it like when you got there? I mean, it must have been a culture and climatic shock.
It was terrible. You know, I'd been sort of uprooted twice. I'd left Jerusalem in circumstances which were terribly sad, ended up in Damascus, which I didn't know. I didn't know my grandparents. I didn't like it in Damascus. I mean, it wasn't home, but at least it was Arab. I spoke Arabic. We were still with family. But then here I was in London, I didn't know any English at all. In fact, I only knew two words of English, Oscar Wilde.
Strange pair of words of English to know, yes.
It's because my father, who was an avid reader of literature, of English, had a large library in Jerusalem, and one of his books was written by Oscar Wilde. And as a child, he taught me the English alphabet, and I finally made out these letters and made them into, because it was quite easy to read. But I didn't know any English. My mother didn't either, my brother didn't, my sister.
And how old were you when you arrived in London?
I was 9. And so this was a much more difficult experience in Damascus, because my parents started me in a school. I didn't know a word of English. I felt alone. I was so miserable. And the whole city was so big. It was cold. It was northern. It was like nothing we'd ever known or seen. My mother was absolutely miserable. She couldn't settle down. She couldn't get over the loss of her home. I don't think she ever really got over it.
Well, then, you clearly, from the way you speak, you did learn English like an English person. And so, but your life there, was it? Did you get really assimilated into English society, or were you able to maintain some connections to an Arab subculture?
Oh, no, not at the beginning. You see, there were very few Arabs in Britain. In the 1950s, late 1940s, 1950s, there were very few Arabs and hardly any Palestinians, which, of course, that's why my mother was so lonely. But we weren't really part of an Arab group at the very beginning. But in a little while, my mother, who never learned English, made friends with what Arabs and Palestinians she could find. And then we had this bizarre setup. I had then learned English. I then became comfortable with my peers at school. But then we had this bizarre situation, which my mother kept a very Arab home. And for readers of Dickens, I would say to you, she was like a Palestinian Miss Havisham, for whom the clock stopped in Jerusalem in 1948, and never moved on. But for me, it was crazy. I would go out of our front door and find myself in England. I would go back through the front door and find myself back in Jerusalem. And it was a very disorienting experience. Very difficult growing up as an adolescent in a situation of split identities like that.
Time is short, so I guess I should fast forward. But how much discrimination did you experience in London? Did people treat you well, or were they hostile? Or?
Actually, not. There wasn't much discrimination. I should say that there were not very many foreigners, as the British called them, in England at the time. And I don't remember having a lot of issues. That came later. That came with the war on Suez in 1956, when the British were split down the middle, half of them very anti-Arab, very anti-Nasser, and of course we were bracketed with the Arabs, so I started to feel it then, but it really got bad during the 1967 war with Israel. Everybody in Britain was pro-Israeli, and you know, all the friends I'd made and all the way I'd settled into England, I actually thought I was English. I suddenly had a rude shock. It was like a slap in the face. I wasn't English at all. If I had been, I would have been on the side of Israel. But of course, I couldn't be on the side of Israel. So it was very obvious that I was not English. So who was I? And then I had this tremendous crisis of identity as to who I was. And I spent the rest of my time up till today clawing my way back to the previous identity of being Palestinian. Much more difficult, of course, because I, in the meantime, had become very anglicized, very westernized, very difficult to reconcile those two opposing poles and make something of them. And I guess this is not a problem confined to me.
Well, but for some exiles, at least there's a comfort that there's a homeland that they can go back to. There wasn't really one for you.
That's right. And this, I think, is the essence of our tragedy. Because for many migrants, immigrant groups in the United States and in Britain, they know that they're not in their own society. They can take of the new society what they want, knowing they can always visit their own homeland whenever they need. They can go and die there. I don't have this luxury. Israel has not only taken my homeland. Let me tell you, it's tried to wipe out my history. It's tried to make out that we were never there, that there was never anything called a Palestine or Palestinians. And my book is my way of saying we are there, we were there, and God willing, we will continue to be there and to return.
And as we record this, the Israeli army is actually rather busy in your home neighborhood, right?
It is indeed. The Israelis really, I think, never gave up on what I can only call the Zionist Project. And the Zionist Project really aimed to displace all the Palestinians and take their land and their property over. This attempt didn't stop in 1948, it didn't stop in 1967, it's going on and on. There is talk today of transferring the Palestinians out of the Palestinian areas under cover of a war with Iraq. Now, I keep hoping this is alarmist talk, that this won't happen, and yet I am afraid, because I was the object of a transfer in 1948, and there is nothing to stop the Israelis from trying it on again. Certainly, no US government appears prepared to halt the Israeli assault on Palestinians.
And have you been back to Palestine?
I have. It was a very painful experience. I went back in the 1990s. I wanted to find my house, and this was a very painful moment for me. I couldn't find it for a long, long time. It's very, very difficult. All the landmarks had gone. The Israelis had replaced all the old houses with something else. Eventually, I did find it, and it was very, very painful to see an Orthodox Jewish family living in it. They didn't want to let me in to even have a look. I couldn't believe that there would come a moment in anybody's life so painful that a home that they had been forced to leave, been taken over by the people who actually didn't even have the decency to say, sorry, we took your home.
Well, because you didn't exist, right?
We don't exist. We were never there. It's a crazy idea. Now, I very much want for people to read this book, not because I've written it, of course not, but because it is a story of actually what happened to us. And people who want to understand why Palestinians feel so badly, why some of them turn to violent methods to try and get something for themselves, if they want to understand that, it seems to me they want to read stories like mine, because I hope and believe that only through beginning to appreciate the thrust of Israel's establishment will we get any kind of progress on not only understanding the case, but gaining support from all decent and right-thinking people of whom I think there are far more in existence than one would believe if you look at government, official government policy.
We're just about out of time, but who is the Fatima of the title?
Ah, now, that is something for the reader to discover when he reads the book. I can tell you this, that Fatima was both a real person, but she was also symbolic. And maybe I should say no more.
Okay, well then we can tease people into buying the book. Thank you for joining us, Ghada Karmi, author of In Search of Fatima, just published by Versa. And good luck with the book. Thank you.
And apologies for the rather poor acoustics of my office, but necessity, you know. So that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And again, next week we'll have Sarah Roy on to talk about the Palestinian economy after her recent visit there. And let's go out with a little more Dmitri Shostakovich String Quartet No. 11, second movement, performed by the Sorrel Quartet.